Ahea oko e ko ka aha. Inahe kuleana i mua o ke a aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nao mai, e malio mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh, give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 17387, De La Pena versus Nation Star Mortgage LLC et al. Arguing for the petitioner, James J. Bickerton. Arguing for the respondent, Terry Louise Cole et al., Michael C. Bird. Arguing for the respondent, Nation Star Mortgage LLC et al., Jade Lynn Ching. Arguing for the respondent, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, Inc., Patricia J. McHenry. Argument on the merits.
Very well. Good morning. Aloha, everyone. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I want to thank Judge Wong for sitting with the court today. During our proceeding, should a justice have a question, they'll raise their hand, and I will call upon them at their earliest opportunity. This morning, we have arguing in front of the court, James Bickerton. Mr. Bickerton, you'll have 23 minutes for your argument, and you've reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Bird, Michael Bird, will go next with 10 minutes, followed by Jay Ching with 10 minutes, and Patricia McHenry with 10 minutes. And then at the end of your allotted time, you'll see a light and hear a tone, and you'll be able to see that light up on the screen. So with that as background, I'll ask Mr. Bickerton to proceed with your argument. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Jim Bickerton, and I'm here for the plaintiffs' appellants, Robin and Ray De La Pena. I will be addressing two separate issues. The court granted the writ on both, and I will first address the question of the continued viability of the Silva holding, and then I will turn to the question of tender. With respect to the Silva holding, only this court may overturn or overrule that case. The ICA essentially usurped this court's prerogative. I think whatever this court decides to do, it is incumbent or appropriate, at least, to issue some sort of opinion like the U.S. Supreme Court issued in the Agostini case, which makes it very clear that where there is an on-point case of some age, perhaps, but it's on point or controlling, that lower courts, including the intermediate court, are not free to wave it away or say it's been impliedly overruled. It must be expressly overruled or it must be followed. That is the position that the U.S. Supreme Court takes with its decisions, and I think that Hawaii law needs something like that because otherwise we may see this problem repeat. The central premise of the opposition to applying Silva isn't that it's not on point. It's that it really isn't good law anymore.
Well, Mr. Bickerton, we had a question from Justice McKenna.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought Justice McKenna had raised her hand. I apologize. Go ahead, Mr. Bickerton.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point that we'd want to make is that this case is really... Of all the cases we've seen, and we've seen quite a few of these, this is the most on point with Silva, or Silva's the most on point with this. We have an auction scheduled one day earlier than was lawful. We have a failure to follow the power of sale violation. And so we have the very same statute that was construed in Silva and applied 10 years after it was adopted. So Silva speaks to this, and Silva was very clear. It walked through the situation. It said, this type of violation is merely voidable, a duty breaching violation, the failure to use the diligent effort, that type of violation is merely voidable. But this one, if you don't follow the power, is absolutely void. They say void, not merely voidable. So we have controlling authority, and the case used an 1874, this case used an 1874 statute, and they complain that we're relying on Silva, we should reply on more modern cases. The three cases that they cite didn't involve a power of sale violation other than Santiago, which the ICA didn't cite Santiago, but the defense cites Santiago. But in Santiago, they didn't say that it was not void. They simply said that it was impracticable to void it because the purchaser was not before the court. In this case, the purchaser is before the court, so we don't have that problem. So there is no distinction or difference, and there's no reason in the case law to overrule Silva. But there is a policy argument that they make, and that's the one that I wanted to talk about, unless the court has questions about the case law.
Justice McKenna, it does have a question at this point. Justice McKenna.
Yes, Mr. Bickerton, you indicate that in Santiago, this court indicated that the problem was that the third party purchaser was not before the court. But was that really what this court stated? It does. This court stated voiding the foreclosure sale at this time has been rendered impracticable because the tavern has already been resold by a tavern by Tanaka to a third party. And it didn't appear to be based on the lack of the third-party purchaser being in the proceeding itself.
Well, Your Honor is correct. They didn't. That is implicit because it is undisputed in the record that that third party was never sued. It must be borne in mind that that third party bought at an auction at a time when Judge Valenciano had ruled the auction for the process was valid. That was upheld. And then the person took while that judgment was in effect, and no bond was ever posted by the Santiagos to stop that from being in effect. So you had a person who had actually bought pursuant to a valid court order, slightly different than just buying directly for real estate owned from a bank. But it is a fact that that person was not before the court, and I think it's important. That's why they said it's impracticable. Because had that person been before the court, it would not have been impracticable. And so we think that that is a distinguishing factor. I don't think you can read an overruling of the careful reasoning in Silva from that statement by the court. And that's what the defense wants you to do.
Let me ask you, I have a follow-up question, if you don't mind. I'm wondering, assuming we rule that it is voidable, not void, then how is a bona fide purchaser for value defined?
Well, that's a very good question, Your Honor. There is some dicta in Condor, because Condor involved a someone who clearly was not a bona fide purchaser. There's a footnote in Condor that says a non-bona fide purchaser is X. Of course, that doesn't define a bona fide purchaser. Hawaii law in the Pelosi case and in the Kau agribusiness case does define a bona fide purchaser, and it has to be someone without actual or constructive notice of the infirmity. And one of the ways that this can be resolved is very simple. Statute 667-5 requires everyone to say in their affidavit that they have what they have done with respect to the things they are required to do. The thing they are required to do is what the power says they're supposed to do. So your affidavit tells the world if you follow the power or not. And it's our contention in these cases, at least, that this particular violation is evident from the power of sale, from the affidavit of foreclosure, and therefore buyers can't be a BFP. And we've made that contention as an alternative to the void versus voidable. The ICA kicked the can down the road and sent it back to Judge Liu, who's already indicated she doesn't agree that that affidavit tells the world anything. But we think that that's the very purpose of the affidavit. So we could prevail on either ground here, but we feel that there's a broader question for sales where the affidavit may not reveal that there was no power. Or, for example, the classic case is that the person didn't breach their mortgage at all. They weren't in default, as in the Lee case, for example. What would have been the remedy in Lee had it been conveyed to a third party? The court says in Mount, well, in dicta, really, because that wasn't before the court there, that, well, that might be just voidable. In Mount, it was voidable because it was a statute violation. So I think that the court does need at some point to wrestle with Silva. I would make this point that Silva cited Roarty, a Massachusetts case, for this very point about the voidness. And the Roarty case continues to be cited down to this day on this point in Massachusetts. We have three separate violations in this case, any one of which would be declared void, not voidable, void by the Massachusetts Supreme Court today. One is the acceleration notice problem, and the Pinty case addresses that. And the other is the sale on the on an unpublished date, and the other is a notice not given for the correct length of time. All three of those have been held by Massachusetts court to be absolutely void.
Mr. Bickerton, could I ask a question?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, coming back to the foreclosure affidavit, is that this type of clear notice that, you know, typically is required to put someone on notice? In other words, isn't there a level of interpretation that would be required of the buyer that is I guess the argument from the defense side would be that, you know, there's sort of a clear note, a clear bright line if there's been litigation filed, for example, but requiring the buyer to sort of comb through the foreclosure affidavit and compare it to law is sort of an excessive burden or too complex a burden. What's your answer to that?
I think that is a point we hear a lot, and there's several answers. First of all, I do want to note on this record, Ms. Cole paid $200,000 for this property, and that county tax record is in the record showing, you know, the values at various dates and who paid what for it on what date. So you have a situation where people are buying from someone who has an obvious break in their title. You don't need to be an interpretive genius to know that this was the Della Pena's property, and here is Fannie Mae giving you a deed, and no one gave, well, the deed they got is from NationStar, and no one gave NationStar a deed. So there's this gap in the title. So any buyer of this type of property, foreclosed property, has a duty, a legal duty, to read the affidavit of foreclosure. And the defense likes to argue, well, who would know from reading it? But the power of sale is just one sentence, and you can tell if it was followed or not.
Oh, Justice McKenna had a follow-up.
Is title insurance available for purchasers at these types of sales?
We have not found a case yet where there was not title insurance. What's happening now, I think, is that some people are not buying these properties from the bank because title insurance isn't available at the jump. But there isn't a situation where someone bought title insurance and has been denied coverage as far as we know. I can't speak for 100% of the cases, but we haven't come across them.
Oh, Justice Nakayama had a question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Bickerton, I think from what I understand that your goal is to unwind this foreclosure and restore your client as a mortgagor.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is how the case was planned.
Didn't your client surrender the property in a foreclosure proceeding?
Thank you for mentioning. Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, that's something that the Ms. Cole's attorneys threw into the brief. They didn't actually argue that in the lower court as a point of law, because they know what the argument to that is. There's a case called In Re Ryan 560 Bankruptcy Reports 339 from Judge Farris, where Judge Liu had this issue in front of her. And I don't know if it was Mr. Bird or someone else who had raised, I think it was actually the Alston firm, now known as Denton's, that raised it. And they we went to Judge Farris and said, look, we want to know what surrender means. And in that case that I reported, which was later mooted because Judge Liu dismissed the case on other grounds and then it settled, Judge Farris said, no, surrender doesn't mean what you're saying. Who are you surrendering it to? It's not like you or I could walk into bankruptcy court and grab it because they surrendered it. The surrender means I'm not claiming an exemption. It means I'm giving it to the trustee to do with as he will. Now, the trustee saw that it was encumbered, and so he did nothing with it. He did not administer it. And therefore, by operation of law, that property reverted back to the Della Pena's. And the In Re Ryan case explains this in great detail. And before it was set aside as moot because of Judge Liu's later ruling, at least three other courts around the country cited in Ray Ryan for this very point.
Justice Wilson.
I can't hear him, Your Honor.
Yeah, you have to unmute, Justice Wilson.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Bickerton, I wanted to get your help in this analysis about the need to overrule Silva. Now, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's no dispute, given the fact that we have to accept the pleadings, the allegations in the completings, there's no dispute that there's been a breach of the power of sale. But I think the proposition that underlies the ICA's position that no longer should we recognize that violation of a power of sale voids the mortgage, but rather that it's voidable. The underlying principle is that in this way, it would better protect a third party purchaser such as the Coles. So if this is the case, that it's clear that there's a violation of the power of sale, why wouldn't we abandon Silva for the proposition that it's merely voidable and under these circumstances a tender is required, a tender offer?
Well, you're switching over to you. There's two questions there, Your Honor, and I do have some remarks about tender in a moment. And it's a very, I think, a separate question. But the question, why should we overrule Silva, is essentially a policy decision. It's not, if you read Silva, it's controlling here. So the question is, should we still follow Silva? Has something changed? The first thing I would say is, actually, the power of sale foreclosures were more widely used by lenders in the 1800s when Silva was decided. So clearly the threat to the stability of the title system was just as great then as they try to make it out now. That's one point I would make. The second point I would make is that this court recognizes void sales in a variety of contexts. So it's not unheard of. And the one is obviously the Hancock case that's been discussed where somebody switches a paper. Here, someone recognized by the statute, Section 10 of the statute says that the mortgagee is acting as agent or attorney for the mortgagor when selling. That person had no authority, and it's a matter of public record that they had no authority in a recorded instrument. The mortgage says what the power is and what they have to do. So you have today, rather than in 1884, you have the Landshark system where we can go on to the Bureau of Conveyances and just see who did what and easily get records. So it's easier today. We also have a comprehensive system of title insurance today, which didn't exist in the 1800s. And finally, something we haven't talked about yet, the banks in these cases are the most well-heeled institutions in the country. And they, or Fannie Mae, gave a warranty deed and stood behind the sale to the buyer. Now, in Silva, if you read Silva 2, they actually gave the buyers their money back plus interest at the judgment rate. And that is, in fact, 478-2 HRS is the judgment rate statute. And it says on a written instrument, for example, breach of lease, you get 10% from the day the rent was due. It's the same thing. Breach of warranty by the bank, it's purchase price plus 10%. I would be happy if my property was appreciating 10% a year. So I think that the policy reasons, the boogeyman that they're raising of, oh, all the chaos that's going to happen, just isn't there. And the answer lies in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, in Alabama, which have all recently held, for example, that failure to give the proper language in the acceleration notice, which we have here, we have an exact violation from the Pinty case, renders it void, not merely voidable. In the Pinty case, the buyer sued the bank. That's a case called Willion, W-I-L-I-O-N, versus Emigrant, after Pinty's had his sale set aside, and the buyer got his money back with interest. That was he said he either wanted interest or his appreciation in the property. I think the case settled before it was decided which one he would get. But in Hawaii, it's clear you get interest.
Mr. Bickerton,
I think there's a lot of reasons why there's no compelling reason to overrule Silva.
Mr. Bickerton, one of the concerns that is often raised is that this would depress the market. People wouldn't want to bid on these properties in the end. That could hurt mortgagors because of the uncertainty, the risk that the property might be ultimately lost after you've already moved forward in reliance on the sale. What's your response to those concerns?
Well, first of all, this is a part one foreclosure, and they don't exist anymore. And in part two, you don't have this problem because there's automatic presumptions that arise if the challenge isn't brought within 30 days. So you have that protection, and we don't know what the market is for part two because the banks have never wanted to try the extra effort that's needed for a part two foreclosure, and they're just going judicial, in which case it isn't a problem. So these auctions aren't happening anymore, but I would make the point that what could be more depressed than mispublishing the notice so that nobody sees the notice except the bank, and the bank ends up just credit bidding? I mean, that if we're worried that it's somehow going to be lower than that, it doesn't make much sense. So I would say it's, again, and it, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Alabama, these other states have dealt with this, and they are not the chaos that the title insurers and the defendants predict has not come to pass.
Did you, oh, Justice Wilson, and then we'll have you talk about the tender rule. Justice Wilson, your follow-up.
I wanted to get back to the tender rule also, and thank you, CJ. And it's my understanding in this case, the determination of the ICA was that the fact that there has been a violation of the power of sale in this case is without a remedy because there hasn't been a tender. So as a consequence, it appears there has been a violation for which your clients would not have a remedy. So I wanted to see if that's your view of the ICA's opinion, and if so, why you would contend that in this case, the tender offer isn't necessary.
Okay, thank you. I'll be brief because we think the issue is fairly clear. We cited a case in our opening brief at page 34. It's the In Re MERS case, 754F3rd772. And they did a summary of the law of California on tender. It turns out that California has an exception to the tender rule for any sale that is voidable or could be, or that is void at least. In other words, if there is a violation that could lead to the voiding of the sale, there's an exception. For mere irregularities, that they don't create an exception. If you want to get your property back and it's an irregularity, you have to tender. But if it is a serious violation, and again, this is why states, every state, and there's a case called Ryback that is cited in the Kekaloha decision by the Ninth Circuit, which is very helpful in listing all the different states and the gradations. They have, you know, three circles of hell, if you will, for differing violations. They don't have a one-size-fits-all like the defense is suggesting here. So in California, they also have more than one gradation. And for the more serious ones, they say you don't have to tender. Now, let me give an example. Suppose I was a non-defaulting party, like the Santiagos, and I had been wrongfully foreclosed, like the Santiagos, and someone says, oh, you've got to tender the full amount that's due on the accelerated loan. Now, especially someone who's been current for 2 years, but they still owe $400,000, and they haven't done a thing wrong. And you're going to say that person must now pony up $400,000 to get their property back? It makes no sense. I will say this, you have a right to get your property back in Hawaii up until there's a lawful sale. Interestingly, a lot of people don't know this, but in Silva, there was a Silva 3, 5 Hawaii 594. And what happened there was they said, okay, we set aside the original sale and we went into equity court. And functionally, what the equity court then did was a judicial foreclosure. And there was a deficiency in that judicial foreclosure. But the court made clear that the tender had to happen before that judicial sale. So that's to stop the judicial sale, not to stop or correct the improper sale. In Silva, they didn't have to tender to stop or undo the non-judicial sale. They just undid it. And then when they did a judicial foreclosure, they had up until the time of the judicial sale to correct the matter. I'd make another point about Silva, which is interesting here, that they had a pleading issue there that it was only pled in equity and no damages or tort was pled. And the result was they set aside an award that Judge Austin made in Silva 2 of $1,500 to Mr. Silva. And later, when it was foreclosed, finally, the deficiency was $1,000. So he was negative on the case. Had he pled the tort claim, as we have done here, he would have come out with a remedy. We think Silva controls 1, 2, and 3 in this case. I do want to make one last point on the tender, and that is paragraph 12 of our complaint alleges all conditions precedent to filing this suit, including any requirement of notice to any party, have been either satisfied or waived. Under Rule 9C of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, if we plead that, we are good to go, and it's up to the defense. So the ICA should not have dismissed the case for failure to plead a specific condition precedent when we had a general allegation like that as permitted by the pleadings. Unless the court has questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I think not at this point, Mr. Bickerton, so we'll move on to Mr. Bird for his argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Mr. Bird.
Good morning, Chief Justice Reckonwald, Associate Justices, and Judge Wong. May it please the court. My name is Michael Bird, and I'm appearing on behalf of appellee Terry Louise Cole and American Savings Bank. In terms of who will be addressing which issues, I will address the void versus voidable issue and the bona fide purchaser issue. Jay Ching will address the power lacking sale versus duty breaching sale issue. And Patricia McHenry will be addressing the tender rule. We'll each argue for roughly 10 minutes. 8 years ago, in 2012, Terry Louise Cole was looking to buy a house on Maui. At the time, she was single and working as an air traffic controller. She found an affordable fixer-upper on the multiple listing service and called the realtor. She inspected the house and put in an offer. The offer was accepted, and in December of 2012, she closed on the house. Over the next few years, she spent about $120,000 fixing up and remodeling the house and made it into her home. And to this day, it's still her primary residence. It is her primary residence, her home, and her largest asset. Nearly 4 years later, in August and October of 2016, Ms. Cole was served with copies of the complaint and the First Amendment complaint in this case. She was scared that she was going to lose her house, and to this day is still afraid that she's going to lose her house after living in her home for 8 years. The legal theory under which appellants seek possession of Ms. Cole's house has to do with the void versus voidable arguments that we've been talking about and have been briefed and have been raised in a lot of cases. In a nutshell, the appellants argue that under the 1884 Hawaii Supreme Court case of Silva versus Lopez, the foreclosure sale that was conducted by appellant's lender, NationStar, violated the power of sale in the mortgage, and thereby voiding the sale and all subsequent sales, including the sale to Ms. Cole. The appellants also rely on an 1877 United States Supreme Court entitled Shalaber versus Robinson for the proposition that when a foreclosure is not conducted in conformity with the power of sale in an instrument, in this case a mortgage, the sale is void. Shalaber was also cited by the Silva Court. We contend, however, that the appellant's reliance on Silva and Shalaber is misplaced. Let's first look at Silva. We've talked about Silva a lot, and Mr. Bickerton talked about Silva. In Silva, the Hawaii Supreme Court was asked to review a lower court decision that was rendered by Justice Austin. Justice Austin was on the Supreme Court, but at the time he was sitting as a presiding judge in a foreclosure dispute between Silva and Lopez. Silva was challenging Lopez's right to foreclose non-judicially against Silva's property and take Silva's property and livestock. Justice Austin rendered a decision, and that decision was appealed by Lopez to the Hawaii Supreme Court. Justice Austin's lower court decision held that the nonjudicial foreclosure was void and not merely voidable. That was Justice Austin's decision. That was not the Supreme Court's decision. He also ruled that the property must be returned to Silva, but he also pointed out in his decision that there was some livestock that had been resold to third-party purchasers, and that for that livestock, damages was the proper remedy for Silva and not the return of the livestock. In reviewing Justice Austin's decision, the Hawaii Supreme Court upheld the decision, but this is really important, but instead of ruling that the nonjudicial foreclosure was void, the Supreme Court actually ruled that the sale was invalid as to the real estate and the livestock. It did not use the word void. That word void was only used by Justice Austin in his lower court decision. In fact, there are two separate references within the Silva One decision where the Supreme Court relied on the sale as being invalid, not void as suggested by the appellant. The only place void was used is, again, it's in Justice Austin's lower court decision. The lower court decision was included in the Silva decision, not as a ruling, but specifically as a discussion and citation of authority. It's like a quotation from the lower court's decision. That's very important. The Supreme Court could have been...
You had a question or have a question from Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Byrd, what do you respond to Mr. Bickerton's argument? NationStar purchased this property for $422,000, and Ms. Cole bought it from NationStar for $200,000. Would that, if this is true, would that give Ms. Cole notice that there was something a little irregular about the mortgage proceedings or the foreclosure proceedings, excuse me?
No, Your Honor. And let me explain why. I think that what you're alluding to is whether or not Ms. Cole would be a bona fide purchaser. And by purchasing for $200,000, then she would have some sort of notice. The house, when she bought it, was in a very rundown condition. It was a fixer-upper. She put in an offer, and it wasn't sold by NationStar. It was sold by Fannie Mae. She put in an offer, and it was sold. It was listed on the multiple listing service. Anybody could have bought that property. It was, I don't know how long it was listed for, but it was listed on the multiple listing service. So she put in an offer. Just by virtue of the fact that she obtained a house for $200,000 would not put her on notice and would not defeat her claim that she's a bona fide purchaser. I think Justice McKenna earlier asked what the definition of bona fide purchaser is. And in the Condor case, footnote 27 defines a bona fide purchaser as one who acquires interest in a property for valuable consideration in good faith and without notice of any outstanding claims which are held against the party by third parties. In this case, the complaint did not allege that Ms. Cole did not purchase the property for value. So that really shouldn't be an issue in this appeal.
Mr. Byrd, we have a question from Justice Wilson.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Byrd, could you help me with your view of what, if any, remedy is available to the Delpinias? In other words, let's assume that this is a matter that would involve a voidable mortgage, and as you say, would involve a bona fide purchaser. If a tender offer was made, what's your view then of what the remedy would be that's available to the Delpinians?
Your Honor, that's a good question. And I think that the tender offer would had to have been made prior to Ms. Cole purchasing the property. It would have had to have occurred prior to the property being sold to a third-party purchaser. In this case, there was a two-year period where the foreclosing lender held onto the property, and before Mrs. Cole bought the property, there was 2 years that it was sitting there. It was actually rented out, from what I understand. And she, it was foreclosed on in 2010. She did not close on her transaction until December of 2012. There was a two-year period where the Dela Pinas could have tendered, made a tender offer, at which time I think that it would have been an avoidable transaction, and the Dela Pinas could have got the property back because it was just being held by the lender. It had not been sold to a third-party purchaser. When it's sold to a third-party purchaser, then it's no longer can be redeemed by the purchaser or anyone else. And in fact, in the Shalaber case, the 1877 Hawaii United States Supreme Court case, the court says that Shalaber could not exercise its right to redeem the property because the property had been sold to innocent purchasers. As such, title is equally beyond the reach of Robinson, Shalaber, and the court. So once it goes to third-party purchaser, the United States Supreme Court says in 1877 that it's beyond the reach of the mortgagor, the mortgagee, and the court. I want to kind of get back to the Silva case. And at the Silva case...
Your 10 minutes is expiring, but I will allow you to wrap up your thoughts at this point. So if you want to make some final points on that case, please go ahead, but please do wrap up.
You know, Your Honor, I think I'd better pass it to Ms. Chang. But I just wanted to touch briefly on Silva, that the Silva does not need to be overruled. Silva ruled that the foreclosure sale is invalid, which under Santiago says, Santiago Court specifically said that where it's determined that the non-judicial foreclosure of a property is wrongful, the sale of the property is invalid and voidable. Santiago is completely consistent with what the Hawaii Supreme Court held in Silva, that the sale is invalid. The word voidable was only used by the lower court in Silva. The Supreme Court held it invalid. I didn't have a chance to get into the bona fide purchaser argument, but I'll let Ms. Ching.
Thank you, Mr. Bird. We'll hear next from Ms. Ching.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jay Ching and I represent NationStar Mortgage and Federal National Mortgage Association. The outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic has led to social changes, swift social changes. We've had a shift away in the way we interact with each other. We've had a shift in the way we work. And our lifestyle change, we have had lifestyle changes. We social distance, we wear masks, we work remotely, we vote by mail. And even in our legal profession, we now participate and appear in hearings remotely. Who would have imagined a year ago that we would be appearing before this court remotely and holding oral arguments? The point is, things change. Society changes. Our laws evolve. What the appellants are asking you to do here is to treat non-judicial foreclosures as if we are still in 1885. They are asking you to look at non-judicial foreclosures in a vacuum, without regard for the evolution of equity jurisprudence. I will be discussing with you today the distinction between power lacking sales and duty breaching sales, and whether there should be a distinction, and whether the power lacking sales are void ab initio. This argument should be rejected for three reasons. First, Silva is not the final word. Equity jurisprudence has evolved over the last 135 years. Second, Silva did not hold that wrongful nonjudicial foreclosures are void. It held that it was invalid and it shaped an equitable remedy. Third, this dichotomy between the power of sale and duty breaching is simply artificial. So to the first argument, is Silva the final word? Appellant's argument necessarily requires that this court ignore that time has passed. It necessarily requires that you ignore that society has changed and that there has been an evolution in equity jurisprudence over the last 135 years. It treats Silva as if it is the final word, and it is not. Since Silva, as Justice Pollack aptly noted in his opinion in Santiago, when he cited to Fleming versus Napoli, equity jurisprudence is not bound by the strict laws of the common law, but can mold decrees to do justice amid all the vicissitudes and intricacies of life. And that is what this court has done.
We have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Ms. Jing. Could you help me then with your analysis of what the equitable remedy would be in this case, where you have a clear violation of the power of sale? And it would appear that there has been no remedy available despite the violation of the power of sale. And there's been a determination made in this case that because there has not been a tender offer, that the Delapinias have no remedy. I mean, is that your view of the proper equitable result in this case?
If in fact it is established that the sale is wrongful and that the sale is invalid, doesn't Santiago and Mount dictate that if the sale is wrongful, it is voidable at the timely election of the mortgagor? And if, as Santiago pointed out, if it is impracticable to vest title back in the mortgagor, then they are entitled to restitution of their out-of-pocket losses. Wouldn't that be their remedy? Isn't that what the evolution of our equity jurisprudence has dictated since Silva I? In fact, in Silva II, that is precisely what occurred. For that property, for that chattel that could not be revested in Silva, the court granted restitution. But the court also in Silva recognized that the mortgagee had rights, and that the mortgagee's rights were practically ignored. In Silva II, the court ordered an accounting to determine what was due and owing to the mortgagee. In Silva I and Silva II, there was a timely election to proceed with their claim against Lopez. That can hardly be said in this case, in which 6 years have passed, over six years before the filing of the lawsuit. And the Ulrich court recognized long ago that, yes, there could be a wrongful foreclosure, and yes, there are these extra common law duties, but there must be a timely election. This notion that the appellant's champion necessarily requires that this court ignore Ulrich, Handauer, Santiago, Mount, and more recently, Hungate,
Ms. Ching, if I could, if the power to sell the property stems from the power of sale, why isn't it logical or sound policy to hold that violations of that sort of fundamental power could indeed render the sale void as opposed to voidable other types of violations of common law or statutory duties? If the entire power stems from that agreement, why isn't it appropriate to hold that those breaches are so fundamental that they render the transaction void?
Isn't that an artificial distinction? That there is a distinction between duty breaching of the power of sale as opposed to breaching the statute? Didn't this court already recognize that and discuss that in Santiago? In Santiago, where it was determined that there was no power of sale. And the court determined that, yes, revesting title was impracticable, and there was restitution. Come forward with Mount. Didn't we already decide that? Didn't your honors already consider in Mount that there was a violation of the statute? The statute was violated, but there's still, it was impracticable to revest, and therefore it was remanded for a very important reason, the innocent purchaser for value. This is an artificial distinction that appellants champion. Nowhere in their first amended complaint is there a distinction between duty breaching and power lacking. They've only ever asked that the sales are always void. There's nothing in their pleadings that draw the distinction. First, I mean, additionally, what's the goal here? What are appellants trying to do here? The good policy reasons for avoiding this bright line rule is appellants are championing strict liability and they're trying to avoid the statute of limitations. What would that effect be? It would mean that we would no longer have the defense of innocent purchaser for value. It would mean to abrogate Santiago and Mount. And it would mean that these mortgagors who have sat idly by for the last 6 years and who in this case surrendered the property will be able to now 6, 10, 12, 15 years later after the supposed violation proceed. Because let's not pretend here, appellants are not asking for prospective relief. They're not asking for this rule to be prospective in nature. They're asking for this rule to be retrospective in nature. And so we will have these non-judicial foreclosure sales that occurred back in the 2006-2008 timeframe, what, automatically void? When that hasn't been the case, that Silva never ruled that these cases were void? Is it fair?
Oh, Justice McKenna.
So, Ms. Ching, what I hear you saying, I believe, is that you believe it should be voidable, and so it would depend on the equities of the situation. For example, if a case like this had been brought immediately after the sale to a third party, before the third party had actually even expended any funds or moved in or anything like that, under those circumstances, perhaps the court could void the sale and have the property returned to the mortgagee. But I'm assuming that understanding is correct. So, but I do have a follow-up question along the line of what you've been saying then. Would the infancy tolling provision of HRS chapter section 657.13 apply to the statute of limitations? For example, if the title in this case had been held for some reason by an infant, would that mean that the statute of limitations would have been tolled until the infant reached the majority? In other words, we could have had a purchaser in that property for, let's say, 20 years before the statute of limitations was expired.
I'm not prepared for that. That's a good question. Are you suggesting that the purchaser, the innocent purchaser, was an infant?
No, I'm suggesting, let's say that the mortgage, for some reason, the title was in the two parents and a baby's name, and the two parents died, so it was the baby that ended up with the title. for some reason, I don't know, and the mortgage got to be continued. I guess that wouldn't happen.
I would think in that situation, Your Honor, that we would, the guardian would have been appointed for the infant. So I'm not certain that that would, that hypothetical would apply in this particular situation.
But so my understanding is correct, however, that you think that it should depend on the equities of each situation in That's terms correct. Of whether they're voidable means look at the situation.
That's correct. That's Thank correct.
Ms. Ching, if we've gone past your 10 minutes, but I will give you some time to wrap up since we had a question there at the very end of your time. So if you could wrap up your argument, then we'll move on to Ms.
Yes, I would ask that it's not necessary for this court at this time to make this distinction between the power of sale violations and duty breaching. This court has already addressed that. And in fact, it's a two-step analysis. It's a two-step analysis that the court has recognized in Santiago and in Mount. And importantly, you shape a decree and a remedy commensurate with the changes and vicissitudes of our society and our evolving equity jurisprudence. If the sale is unlawful or wrongful, it is invalid and voidable at the timely election of the mortgagor. But if, as stated in Santiago and Mount, and again in Hungate, if avoiding the foreclosure is not practicable or not possible, then the mortgagor is entitled to some other remedy, restitution of its proven out-of-pocket losses. This is not such a case. Making this decision now, drawing a bright line rule between power lacking sales and duty breaching sales, is not necessary to the De La Pena decision. And more importantly, it's a false and artificial dichotomy. This court has already addressed those issues, and we'd ask that they reject the appellant's argument.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Ching. We'll move on now to Ms. McHenry for her argument.
Let me take off my mask. Time, sign of the times. May it please the court. I represent Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, which, as your honors know, is one of Cole's mortgagees. And I will be addressing the challenge to the tender rule, which is appellant's challenge to tender rule, which is a defense to appellant's quiet title claim. Before I go there, I just wanted to have provide a response to a couple of the points or questions that were previously raised. And I'll try to do that very briefly so that I can get on to my argument, if that's all right. Your Honor, Justice McKenna, I believe that you asked a question about whether title insurance is now available on these as a result of non-judicial foreclosures. It's not. Title insurance companies, in fact, will not now issue title policies for people who currently are the current owners, such as Cole, of property, because they do not want to get into this quagmire if a sale is void. And they,
Justice McKenna.
Then does that not provide an argument for the plaintiffs in this case that the parties, purchasers, are on notice that there's a problem with title if you can't even purchase title insurance?
That's now, Your Honor. It's after the cases have been brought by Mr. Bickerton, because previously people were able to get title insurance, but it's now that they cannot get title insurance. They've seen some of the decisions, uncertainty that's come down, and that has caused them to be extremely, they won't issue title policies. And so that's a current problem. And there are obviously thousands of people who are now subsequent owners to properties that were non-judicially foreclosed upon. So it has wide implications, even though non-judicial foreclosures are essentially over, but there are still thousands of people who will be affected. And Justice Wilson, I also believe that you talked about the issue of remedies and whether there would be a remedy that's available. Well, I think that the remedy that the Delapenas would have would be their damages for wrongful foreclosure. And that would be a separate claim. So they would have the wrongful foreclosure claim. And that remedy would be monetary damages and not the return of title. Now, if I can, unless your honors have any other questions, I can go on to my arguments. The appellants pray that in their First Amendment complaint for a judgment quieting title against defendants. However, their quiet title claim is really only against Cole. And if I could use Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, if I could use the abbreviation MERS, if that's all right. It's a long name. And that quiet title is only against Cole and MERS. The essence of a claim for quiet title is that they're competing claims to the same property. And the plaintiff alleges that its claim is superior. However, who currently has title? It's only Cole. And MERS has its mortgage on Cole's interest. The appellants currently do not have title. And so the quiet title claim that they have really is against MERS and Cole as to getting title, asserting that their title is superior. They, in fact, appellant, if you look at appellant's First Amendment complaint, it therefore seeks only to have, like in paragraph 48, the interest of Cole extinguished and the claims of the mortgagees whose mortgages are on Cole's interest. So the claim is that really and essentially against quiet title claim is really essentially against Cole and MERS. And I can say in the many other more recent cases that Mr. Bickerton has brought, the quiet title claims are clearly denominated as being only against the third party purchasers and their mortgagees. Now, the quiet title claim is an equitable action. And therefore, the rules of equity apply. One of those longstanding rules, and certainly not limited to California, as Mr. Bickerton would imply, is that someone who seeks equity must do equity. And in the mortgage context, that equitable rule requires that a mortgagor challenging a foreclosure as allegedly invalid and asserting a quiet title claim must allege the ability to tender. They can tender. Now, to be clear, and again to clarify, we are not saying that the tender rule applies when the sale is, if the sale were to be determined to be void. The tender rule applies when the sale is voidable, because that's when equitable defenses and defenses are available and possible. So that, and Mr. Bickerton was talking about California cases and void versus voidable. Well, here we are talking about that the tender rule applies when a sale is voidable.
Ms. McHenry, could I ask you a question? And by the way, you're a little bit off center if you want to just...
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. That's probably just... There you go. The tender rule, it seems the cases on the mainland to have evolved early in situations where there's a dispute between the mortgagor and their mortgagee. And the thought being that there could be a situation where the mortgagor would get a windfall by, in essence, extinguishing the mortgage without having paid the amounts due. But is that rationale, you know, even applicable in the situation here where MERS, I don't believe, MERS is, if I understand correctly, Ms. Cole's mortgagee, correct?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor.
So how does it, you know, first of all, isn't it a somewhat unusual application of the rule? And does it, in your view, how does it make sense to apply the rule in this context?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it's even more equitable in this context to apply a rule such as this. Certainly there are cases in California, such as a Tang case that we cite, that does apply, talk about applying the tender rule in the context when there has been a sale to third parties down the road. And the rationale for doing that is that it's even, you know, more calls for equity when you have people who have purchased the property and, you know, they need to be able to, you know, the here in this particular case, the appellants are seeking to go down the chain of title down to Cole and MERS to void those, to try to get them declared void or voidable, to eliminate them, to extinguish them, to wipe them out. So given that the appellants are seeking to go down the chain of title, it should just be an equity. They must have the right then to go back up the chain of title to allege that there needed to be a tender.
Oh, Justice McKenna.
But what of the situation? Let's put aside all the timing issues in this case. Let's assume this case had been brought right after Ms. Cole had purchased the property, before she had moved in or expended $120,000. At that point, it appears that the Delapinas are saying, this was a wrongful foreclosure. There was no power of sale. We want to go back to the status quo. The status quo would be, we own the property, and the mortgagor has the mortgage, and we still owe what's based on that. We just want to go back to the status quo. We're alleging wrongful foreclosure. We're claiming damages arising out of the wrongful foreclosure, but we just want to go back to the status quo where we own the property subject to the mortgage. Why would they have to then? And then at that point, if they were still in default, it appears that the mortgagee would be able to file a proper foreclosure, whether it's a part two or a judicial foreclosure. Let's say they file a judicial foreclosure and they go ahead and proceed on that judicial foreclosure. But why would they have to pay for the mortgage, pay the entire amount due on the note, if they're saying, put us back to the status quo? You did not have the authority or power to non-judicially foreclose. So get us back to where we were, and we start anew from there.
Your Honor, I think that Mr. Bickerton's, in fact, if you look at the First Amended complaint, the First Amended complaint does not say anything about the mortgage being off the property. The First Amended complaint, in fact, alleges that the 2007 mortgage will remain on the property. And they then, the appellants also then say, well, then if the mortgage is on the property, and if we are still in default after the at that point, then.
So why would they have to pay off the mortgage? Why would they have to tender the note?
I don't think that they need to pay off, is what I'm saying. I think that if you have a situation in which there has been a plaintiffs, such as if this lawsuit is brought, and they allege, well, put us back then back into that situation, but the default of the mortgage has to be cured, not the entire debt paid, to be put back into the situation where they were, the status quo, Your Honor, the term that you use. The status quo at that point would be that the mortgagee would have the right to foreclose at that point, if the amount that's in default is not tendered or is not paid. So our position is that
we have a follow-up from Justice Wilson.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know you're focused on this notion of the inequitable result to your client, and understandably so if she is an innocent third-party purchaser. But returning to this proposition that you have that the interests of your client justify the violation of powers of sale by entities such as mortgagees, the injury to your client is such that it would require just accepting that powers of sale are violated, and that once the property is transferred, that the only remedy might be a sort of a damages claim, as opposed to getting the property back and allowing for that party who's originally had the property and who potentially could contend that perhaps they were complying with the mortgage, rather than allowing them to get the property back. It just seems to me that it would be helpful to get your view about why is it more equitable to just assume that a practice of violating powers of sale cannot result in a return of the property once a third-party purchaser participates in some way, such as, I guess, purchasing the property, even if it's purchasing it without notice of an infirmity. Why is it more equitable to just accept this practice of by mortgagees who no doubt are in a position oftentimes of great influence, just accepting that they're violating the power of sale?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have multiple parties. You have the mortgagor, but then you also have these other parties, and the equity balances those interests. And what you're proposing is that then just accepting there's been a violation of the power of sale and everything goes back.
Well, I'm not necessarily suggesting that. I'm suggesting that this be an option that's available to the court. You know, you have an action that's brought based on the violation of the power of sale. Okay, let's accept the proposition that's voidable. But why not allow this action to go forward so the court can make a determination in equity as to whether or not the property should go back to the defendants as opposed to staying with the Coles?
Well, Your Honor, you have inherently the claim for quiet title. It requires that the mortgagor, or the appellant in this case, would have superior title. And to have superior title, they would need to have to pay, and they're offering only to have the mortgage stay on the property.
But in a sense, this idea of a superior title is accepted, as analyzed by the pleading. We have to accept the allegations to be true in the complaint. So this idea that there's superior title with your client or with respect to the Depenia seems to be, in terms of the complaint, a proposition that is straightforward. If you accept the complaint, the Depenias have had the power of sale violated, and therefore their property was not foreclosed properly. So why wouldn't you assume that under those facts, they have superior title?
We are not disputing the allegations in the complaint with respect to the alleged invalid foreclosure. Okay. The premise is that the sale is voidable. And that was kind of where I began my argument. So that there would be a voidable sale, not void. And if it's voidable, then there are defenses to that, including the bona fide purchaser defense, as well as the tender rule defense.
Very well. Ms. McHenry, we've gone well over your time, but there were questions at the end of the allotted time, so I'll allow you a brief summary for the court at this point.
Well, thank you, Your Honors. I do want to point out that the tender rule is based upon sound, equitable considerations. And one thing I do want to stress, to the extent that Mr. Bichtigan argues that he should have been allowed to amend the complaint. However, he did not. Mr. Bickerton, the appellants did not argue on appeal or down below that they should be allowed to amend, not ask that they be allowed to amend, and therefore they have waived any argument with respect to that. And we would ask, therefore, that the court then affirm the ICA decision as well as the lower court decision regarding the tender rule. Thank you.
Very well, thank you for your argument. Mr. Bickerton, your rebuttal.
Addressing first the point by Ms. McHenry that this is an equitable action, that's what they want. They want to tug at the heartstrings. You heard a lot of facts from all of the counsel that are not in the record. But if you go back and you start in 1898, Flores v. Maca, 1898, Kidwell versus Godfrey, 1902, Hakalau Plantation, Mossman v. Dole in 1902, going up to 1927 in Yoshimasu v. Huizen, case after case says that an action to quiet title is an action at law. It's a statutory action under Chapter 669. You have two elements to it. It is not an equitable action.
Mr. Bickerton, we have a question from Justice Nakayama for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Bickerton, what is your response to Ms. McHenry's suggestion that if the action is voidable, and that tender doesn't mean tender of the entire amount due, but that it means to cure the default?
I heard that, and that was going to be my next point. My jaw dropped. That's an outrageous statement by them, because they send an acceleration notice. They're not allowed to do this foreclosure unless they've timely sent the acceleration notice and they've properly stated the content that they're required to stay and give you the proper notice. And then the entire debt is accelerated. When they sold it, they bid $400,000, not the arrearage, the cure amount. If she's saying all we owe is the arrearage of whatever $15,000 or $18,000 that someone's behind after 3 or 4 or 5 months, then why didn't we get some of that $200,000? That is just a ridiculous argument, the idea that tender just means to cure the current arrearage after they've accelerated the entire debt. Now, we do have a pinty point here, and I keep stressing this. We have a failure to give a proper acceleration notice. Pinty's on all fours. So I would say that I'd like to just quickly talk about the void versus invalid, because this is where they're trying to get you away from Massachusetts, which we followed in 1884. And they say, oh, Silva didn't hold it was void. They said it was invalid. Actually, they used that for the first point of error. For the second point of error, they didn't characterize the breach of the power. They said, we adopt Justin Austin, and the exact words I'll give you as I highlighted it here. They said, for the full discussion and citation of authorities on this head, we refer to the opinion of Mr. Justice Austin. That's why they took the very unusual step of actually publishing and incorporating his lower court opinion into the published Volume 5 opinion. They didn't do that in every case. And they specifically said, we're adopting his view. So this idea that Silva didn't hold it void and not merely voidable is wrong. That's the holding of Silva. We got to face it. You are free to overrule it today, but I stress that other courts have not done so. I want to make another point, which is this is a lien theory state now, but it was a title theory state as Massachusetts remains when it adopted this. And I was surprised yesterday to discover, I wanted to compare states that don't allow non-judicial and states that do with title theory and lien theory. the study that I saw said there are 25 judicial foreclosure only states, although they counted Hawaii in that. And I think that's Hawaii is a bit of a hybrid. And there are 25 that allow non-judicial foreclosure currently. And in those of title theory are 22 out of 25 of the ones that allow non-judicial. And lien theory are 22 out of 25 of the ones that only go judicial. It tells me that this is a creature of title theory, this type of foreclosure, the power to just go ahead and sell. That's like the mortgagee has this ownership right. And we should follow, if we're going to allow this law to still operate in a lien theory state, we should at least look at what the title theory states do today with the same law that we copied from them. We copied this law from Massachusetts. The Pinty case said this is void and not merely voidable, and we have to address that. I want to make another point about Pinty, which is they protected some of the horrible reasoning that, that the defense offers, and they said we're going to make our ruling prospective only for those people who are in the pipeline right now. This is the ruling on the acceleration letter. And that's what they did. And there's a case after that called Marroquin, M-A-R-R-O-Q-I-N in Massachusetts, where they explained it covers the Pinty prospective ruling covers any case that was on file at the time the Pinty decision came down. That's certainly one way that you can limit the effect of holdings here. This last point about timely election that Ms. Ching made and others have made, that is clearly a rule of voidable, and that's why you need to have some sales that are absolutely void, because there's certain situations, and I can't identify all of them, where you have to be able to act even if some time has passed because of the injustice. I want to stress last thing, which is the bona fide purchaser issue has been well and detailedly briefed in some other cases, and not so much in this case, although it was briefed to some extent in the opening brief that we filed, and it wasn't addressed by the ICA, and it isn't directly an issue here as to whether or not the foreclosure affidavit gives notice to buyers. Somehow or some way, people who are the victims of wrongful foreclosure need to be able to get their property back, whether it's through saying it's void for the power of sale violation, or that there is no bona fide purchaser because they got notice from the affidavit. There has to be some recourse. This idea that they're just going to get out-of-pocket losses, and that's the only remedy they can get, and they've lost their home, it could be a family home of generations, just doesn't sit right, and it's inconsistent with existing Hawaii precedent. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to all of our attorneys for your argument today. This court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'o mololo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki'e ki'e hanohano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.